Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the owner of Arizona's largest egg producer says it's time to vaccinate their flocks. And we meet the new dean of ASU's Herberger Institute on the importance of art and design in today's world. But first, Republican lawmakers at the state capitol are advancing a bill this week that would require law enforcement to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. As hundreds of protesters rallied outside, calling for justice for immigrants and rallying against the Trump administration's policies. Senate President Warren Peterson says the bill is about helping the president's mass deportation efforts, but critics say the bill is too broad and it won't just target criminals.
The consequence of that is racial profiling, it is family separation, and it will cost Arizona taxpayer dollars.
That's former state lawmaker Raquel Teran speaking at the protest. Activists like her are concerned that we will see what we've seen before in Arizona, immigrant communities in fear of calling the police. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk was at the Capitol as the protest played out on President's Day, and she's here now in studio to tell us more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so this bill is a big one, a controversial one, because of the kind of broader political environment right now. Tell us first exactly what it would do.
Well, basically, it says that the local and state law enforcement officers need to collaborate with ICE and federal immigration law. Specifically, it requires our local law enforcement to hold people who are crime suspects who have ICE detainers. So.
Right.
Basically helping not by deporting them physically, but by holding them and then giving them over to ICE.
Right.
And prohibiting, you know, communities, for example, from fighting back against any federal immigration policy from Trump.
Right. So immigration law is supposed to be strictly federal, right? That must be part of this debate. But also lots of law enforcement agencies in the state already do this.
Yeah. So there's a thing called 287G agreements, which I think are voluntary, but are also a very common thing, which is basically similar to this. It's having local agencies work with the federal government and I think the Department of Homeland Security. But this one would basically be the requirement version of that. So it's like the amped up version of that.
Okay.
And as for what you were saying about federal immigration law being a federal issue, yes, that has come up. Democrats have said that repeatedly. It's something that was kind of made clear to Arizona on the other way with SB 1070
right.
when the courts were like, no, you can't do that because this is our job as the federal government. And you have to respect that, even if we're not bothering to, like, do our job and actually, you know, help you guys with the situation.
Always the debate. So we've seen at least one Arizona sheriff, Santa Cruz County Sheriff David Hathaway, who has said he is pulling his deputies out of one of these programs where they cooperate with federal immigration authorities. This one's called Operation Stone Garden. And he said just because of this, he doesn't want to see Latinos in his community, and that's most of the community there, be afraid to call law enforcement. Is this bill in response to stuff like that?
It could be in response to that stuff like that. I think it's that's just one example here, and I think that it speaks to the fact that people have apprehensions about this in communities, especially mixed communities. Even if someone's not here and an undocumented immigrant, they might know someone or be in a mixed status family, and so there's concern from Democrats in particular, but not just Democrats, that people could be too afraid to basically do anything, to you know, go to school, to go to the doctors, to call the police, especially, more than anything else. And that could actually be detrimental to communities because things go without being reported, basically.
Yeah. So tell us more about this protest you attended this week. This was big and it got contentious. The Senate was locked down for some time, right?
It was a partial lockdown. I was just curious about it because as I was walking in, they had only one entrance open and they were filtering who could come. And I hadn't usually, you know, seen that before. And so it turns out they went into a partial lockdown because protesters had kind of tried to, I don't want to say rush the doors, but all come in at once. And some people got excited and there was yelling and apparently some people were banging on the doors. And so Senate leadership decided to put in some security measures, although there were some people already in the building from the public. So those people got to stay and watch the hearing, although they did limit public comment. So some of the protesters were really frustrated because they sent in all these representatives, right? All these people who wanted to talk and fill the hearing room, but only three of them, I believe, got to speak at all.
Right. Okay. So talk about what might be next for this legislation at the state capitol. Republicans have the votes to pass this through the Senate, through the House, but we have a Democratic governor, Katie Hobbs. Should we expect her to veto this?
So we asked her about that at a press conference, and she basically said that this is unnecessary because she mentioned, you know, we already do have these agreements available. And she also said that we don't necessarily want to always be in lockstep with the federal government. And maybe the Republicans don't want that either, depending on what the presidential administration looks like in the future. I mean, that's something that they complained about a lot under Biden. And this requires us to be in lockstep with them for any of their federal immigration policies, essentially. That's her argument. So it's looking like a veto if it gets to her desk. It could be really good veto fodder. It could be, you know, a good press release to issue as Republicans saying, oh, you know, the governor doesn't care. The governor wants to protect criminals and undocumented immigrants. And if and when she vetoes it, they could also send it to the ballot. And so it could be a ballot question in 2026, potentially.
Yeah, we could see this on the ballot. But we also have a political side of this, right? Like Hobbs is facing a potentially very tough reelection campaign in just a couple of years, which is very not much time, right, in politics these days. We've seen her move to the center, move to the right on some issues. Could this be one of them?
I want to say no about this one. She just did her first veto of the year yesterday. We always look forward to that. she's been a veto record setter, and I don't see her passing this bill, frankly, especially since the one that she vetoed was not even as contentious.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there for now. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk joining us as she does. Cameron, thank you so much for your reporting here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The bird flu is quickly becoming a crisis here and across the country. Millions of birds have died, thousands of cows are getting sick, dozens of people have been infected, and there are no eggs on grocery store shelves. And scientists are increasingly warning that this fast-spreading virus is getting dangerously close to spreading to humans. Here in Arizona, the state's largest egg producer says he has lost more than 1 million birds due to the bird flu. And he's concerned the virus will continue to wreak havoc on the industry and potentially on people as well, unless he is able to vaccinate his flocks. Glenn Hickman is the president of Hickman's Family Farms, based in Buckeye. He welcomed news late last week that the USDA conditionally approved a vaccine against the bird flu for poultry. But they're still awaiting the okay from the Trump administration before they can join other major countries around the world and use it. He told me it's a dangerous waiting game.
Our family operates four farms here in Arizona. One farm was infected in November and reinfected again in January after we started to refill it. So we've lost about 1.1 million birds out of our flock.
Wow. Okay. And I don't want to get too graphic for people, but that's a lot of animals. How do you do this?
Well, it takes a large crew. You know, we cycle through flocks anyway. But we've never had to put a whole farm down at one time. So
right.
this was a quite a massive undertaking. We had about 100 people that removed birds and unfortunately carcasses from the farm and had to dispose of them.
Yeah. And was it clear, like, how did you detect bird flu among that particular farm?
This particular variant of bird flu is very, very virulent with a high level of mortality. So from the time we saw the first bird starting to exhibit some symptoms to the time that, you know, virtually the entire farm had perished was about 7 days.
Wow. So fast.
Very fast.
Okay. Does this take an emotional toll on workers, on the operation itself?
Everyone in our company has been affected to some degree, whether you work with the animals in the processing plant, heck, even customer service, because we have customers wanting to know where their eggs are, you know, when their truck's going to get there. And you have people that used to work at a farm that the farm is completely empty. So, I think it's challenged every single person on, you know, that works with us.
Okay. So there must be a slew of precautions that you're taking now to keep workers safe, to keep your flock safe, to keep the product safe, right? Tell us a little bit about the extent of that.
You know, it's like operating a very, very large hospital because we're trying our dangest to keep the disease, you know, at the fence line. So you know, on the first order of defense, if your vehicle penetrates the fence line, it's going to get washed at least once, in some cases twice.
Wow.
And then washed and disinfected. Then if you go into the barns, you're going to take a full shower, put on company clothes, go do your work, and then do the same thing on the way back out. So we don't want you to bring a disease in, and we don't want you to take a disease out potentially. We try to keep everything picked up. You know, if a pound of feed is spilled, we try to sweep that up so that no wild birds are attracted. It's just an ongoing full-time job.
Is there any way to completely quarantine them?
All of our flocks live indoors, both the caged and the cage-free. They don't have outdoor access. But this virus is airborne. It rides on dust particles. And so, you know, what we know now is that we have pressure from existing wild bird populations around our Maricopa farm. So we've had some recently, even though there's no laying hens down there, we've been trapping wild birds and such, and we've been testing them, and they're positive for avian influenza.
Wow. So it's just spreading incredibly fast.
It's faster than we can keep on top of it.
Okay. So let's talk about the consumer end of this, right? The side the rest of us are all experiencing. The price of eggs has just, you know, shot up because of this epidemic and because farms are having to do what you're doing all over the country. Is this in any way a financial boon to you? Is it the opposite? Are you taking major losses because you lost an entire operation?
It's both. So, yes, the farm that got depopulated, the federal government makes you get rid of the entire flock, which we were going to have to do anyway. They virtually all died. Then you clean it up and disinfect it. And the government reimburses you for the loss of the flock and the cleanup process. The government doesn't reimburse you for the eggs that aren't getting produced.
Sure. So it will take a while, I'm guessing, for your business to get back up to where it was.
Well, the industry takes a while to recover because we don't have the capabilities to just grow a whole bunch of extra birds at one time. We're pretty well matched. The system is geared up to replace older birds when they retire, and that's what we have. We don't have the ability to just double that up.
Right, right. Is there added pressure right now because of the consumer demand for eggs and because of the, you know, sometimes complete scarcity of them on the grocery store shelves to get eggs out quickly?
Eggs are in about 99% of all refrigerators, and so the demand is very inelastic. People want eggs, and they don't really decide whether to buy eggs or not based on price. So
right.
Even though the price has gone up, the demand is still there.
That's interesting. So you're not seeing people give up on it and say, it's too much money, I'll just not have eggs this week.
I'm sure there's a little bit more cereal being eaten, but the demand has been pretty rock solid. Gotten some good news just over the weekend where the government approved a vaccine. What they haven't approved yet is that we can use it, but we think that'll be forthcoming. The frustration that we've had in our industry is that in Europe, the birds are, you know, several companies are vaccinating their poultry.
Sure.
And when we talk about poultry, we're talking about commercial ducks, turkeys, meat hens, and layers. They vaccinated them all. What's been very frustrating is that vaccine was actually being manufactured here in the United States, but we couldn't use it.
So how long has that been available in European countries?
I think they've been vaccinating for over a year now.
Okay. What's been the delay here? Why can't you get your hands on this vaccine yet?
You know, I think a lot of it is based on the fact that, you know, while the laying hen industry needs it, the meat bird industry has been largely unaffected. They have a very young bird that they harvest at, say, 6 weeks old. This disease doesn't seem to affect the youngest birds. Maybe there's some maternal antibodies there, that kind of thing.
Interesting.
So they have a whole different set of circumstances.
So what are your concerns going forward? I mean, if you can at some point vaccinate your flocks because the USDA has finally agreed to allow this vaccine to go through and then you get the subsequent approval you're waiting for from the federal government, what do you think this might look like?
Well, it's going to take about 2 years to get the birds fully vaccinated because that lifespan of our birds is about 2 years. So they have to be vaccinated in the growing stage. And from what we understand, it's a vaccination at 5 weeks and at 12 weeks. And then they move into the layer barns at about 18 weeks. So it'll take a while to get everything vaccinated, but it is a step in the right direction.
So what's your prediction on how long it might take the industry and the egg shelves, the egg supply in general, to catch up?
Well, our industry is fully supplied when we have about 330 million layers.
Wow.
And so right now we think we're around 275 million layers. So you can see there's a huge gap there. Mm. That gap can get addressed by taking eggs, frozen eggs or dried eggs, out of storage. We also, the government just approved a large import of 800 containers of eggs from Turkey. So those wow. eggs can go, they're broken, pasteurized, and dried, and that can go to industrial uses. So that'll relieve some of the pressure of the supply issue.
Okay. Are you concerned about this virus continuing to spread or not getting a vaccine soon enough? It continues to mutate. It passes to humans, things like that.
Lauren, everyone should be concerned about that. Right now, it's a disease that's impacting the cost of eggs. If we don't stop the spread, if we continue to let it mutate, then we could have it mutate to the point that we do have human-to-human spreading, and then we will wish we had vaccinated the animals a lot sooner.
Yeah, and you, it sounds like, have been outspoken about this, saying we need to vaccinate now.
I keep telling everybody we need to vaccinate the animals so we don't have to vaccinate the people.
All right, we'll leave it there. Glenn Hickman, president of Hickman's Family Farms, joining us to talk more about this bird flu. Glenn, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, words aren't always enough to express an idea. We'll hear from the new dean of ASU's Herberger Institute on the importance of art and design in modern society. But first, whether it's an ad for shoes we Googled once that pops up on every website we visit, or being asked for our social security number when we call our dentist, having our personal information tracked and recorded can seem like part of the fabric of life in the 21st century. But who's collecting all this data, and what's it being used for? Anita Say Chan argues that these are hardly modern questions. In her new book, Predatory Data, Chan traces the roots of data mining and manipulation back more than a century and sounds the alarm about its dangerous origins. Chan recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
Eugenics, as I outline in the book, was really the kind of foundation for so many of the kinds of population management techniques that rely on datafication, from, you know, our AI-driven biometric ID systems to criminal databases, even our passport systems, which all require a kind of version of datafying human populations. All of those systems were very much owed to eugenicists from over 100 years ago.
In order to create a pretext for this datification, there first needs to be a perception that there is some significant problem that would require the collection of all this data to solve. And you go back as far as 1883 and a guy named Francis Galton.
Francis Galton was the father of eugenics, and in 1883 was when he first termed the movement as eugenics and called this program that he had for being able to essentially, as he thought, predict which populations could be predicted to be genetically predisposed to unfitness, mental, moral, and physical unfitness. He's credited with also founding statistical regression, which is, again, sort of the foundation for all of our predictive methods in that we see in our data economy today. Galton's obsession with numbers and counting was very much driven by his own anxieties that the patrician elite of the West would slowly be degraded because of these sorts of new proximities and new forms of diversification, global diversification. And so from the get-go, he was doing things like trying to correlate the number of talent and genius to the elite families of Europe, counting things like in Who's Who's dictionaries from England and from France, and trying to essentially use those patterns to make arguments that the well-born breed the well-born.
Yeah, that classic canonical text, the Who's Who dictionary.
Correct. Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
But when, as you were just pointing out, I mean, I think one of the contextual things that's important here is what else was happening in history at this time. We're talking about the beginning of industrialization, and in the late 19th century, American society really remaking itself in the post-Civil War context. And so you can see where people like Galton, who had this kind of patrician identity that they felt needed to be protected from all these new factors might want to come up with a supposedly data-driven set of systems that would reify that status. If we move forward about 100 years in history, that backdrop that we have been discussing is what informs a lot of the datafication environment that we find ourselves in now. And one of the people who you really locate a lot of the blame for this on is Peter Thiel, who in 2009 talked about how it was important to make the world, quote, safe for capitalism.
Yeah. I mean, if people are not familiar with or hadn't heard about him, he's a venture capitalist, a funder, co-founder of PayPal, investor in any number of different companies from Facebook to Airbnb, Spotify. But since 2009, he was quite clear that he no longer saw a kind of compatibility between democracy, and that is democratic policy, and the evolution of tech.
Well, and here, yes. I mean, you know, if we go back to his quote, you know, make the world safe for capitalism, that makes it sound like, you know, we're safeguarding some sort of fundamental American value. But actually, what he's talking about is maintaining an economic environment that allows him and other folks in the tech industry to continue enrich themselves.
That's right. Yeah. You see it every time he speaks. It really is for him a deeply ingrained kind of moral cause that, from his point of view, the world is fundamentally unequal. People are fundamentally and born unequal, that there is no point trying to enable some version of social mobility, and that it irresponsibly takes resources away from the people who should be empowered, the cognitive elite, the Silicon Valley elite. I mean, it's a deeply, deeply problematic and dark kind of vision, but that is exactly the kind of vision and why the attacks that we see, the institutional attacks that we're seeing today are really as bold and as radical as they are. This has been a kind of experiment that they have been waiting to have for quite a long time.
Yes. And you know, we should say here that Elon Musk, who is making a number of the institutional attacks that you were just referring to, is very much philosophically in line with Peter Thiel. And
yes, yeah.
I guess I just wanted to ask you, Anita, I mean, I get the sense very much that the argument that you're making in this book is that the metrification of all avenues of life is very easy to spin as mere data collection and, you know, valuable information by powerful interests, but it's also very easy to use the warped conclusions that that metrification can lead to as a precursor for a majoritarian or even an authoritarian state. Is that a concern that you have?
Oh, absolutely. This is why, you know, Sam, your early question about the existential risk that that eugenicists from the 19th century were posing as the backdrop to necessitate the kinds of radical policies they were asking for.
Right.
Sterilization, remaking of immigration law. They used the kind of backdrop of existential risk as a means to be able to get those policies furthered. So too, when we're looking at what's happening now under government, under this kind of experiment that we're seeing happening, it is very much a kind of imperative of exceptionalism. Precisely because of this kind of backdrop, supposedly, of wanton waste that will lead, or that it has been leading, as Maugites have claimed, to a kind of existential risk to the nation.
If we go back to the Peter Thiel quote of the idea of making the world safe for capitalism, you know, if you phrase it that way, it's much harder to make an argument against it. Much in the same way, if you say, "Oh, it's just the Department of Government efficiency,"
right,
which leaves out, of course, efficiency in service of what?
Right, exactly. Elon Musk has had any number, even prior to his endorsement of Donald Trump, has had any number of on the record statements saying that he believes civilization is on the demise, and has been on the record for talking about at length with other Silicon Valley about how Silicon Valleyites should have more babies. So he has a strange pronatalism, and he connects this to the idea that if we don't have more babies, as he says, if we, as in Silicon Valleyites, don't have more babies, civilization will fall. It's such weird outdated language. Like, it feels very out of the blue for a modern audience, but it is straight out of Galton's 1863 publications.
Well, the book is called Predatory Data, and Anita Sei-Chan is also a faculty member in the School of Informational Sciences at the University of Illinois. Anita, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
In part two of our special report, Overwhelmed, Athena Ankra and Amy Silverman report on the complexities for people diagnosed with both autism and serious mental illness, and the complexities inside the Arizona State Hospital when it's charged with providing care to a patient with a dual diagnosis. Here's the show's Athena Ankra.
If you've lived in metropolitan Phoenix for any amount of time, chances are pretty good that you've driven past the Arizona State Hospital and never knew it. Located on 90 acres at the northeast corner of 24th and Van Buren Streets, the hospital complex is wrapped in chain-link fencing, lined with razor wire, and trimmed in hot pink bougainvillea.
Last year, the bushes were cut way back, and now it's possible to see orange-clad patients exercising on the dead winter grass. There are mysterious, gorgeous old buildings that may or may not be occupied today. A newer administrative building with a big no trespassing sign hundreds of yards in front of the entrance keeps the place shrouded in secrecy, and employees leaving at shift change look away from observers standing on the trash-covered public sidewalk. If you have heard of the State Hospital, it's probably in regard to Winnie Ruth Judd, the infamous trunk murderess who was a patient at ASH between 1933 in 1971.
You escaped from the Arizona State Hospital seven times.
Yes, but I hadn't escaped then. I waited 7 years before I did.
Okay, but you left the hospital seven times.
Yes.
That's Judd in a 1969 documentary produced by KTAR.
On the southwest corner of the ASH grounds, a small structure is being built to someday provide transitional housing for a few dozen patients. On the far northeast end, there's a long, unkempt lot packed with graves of long-ago ASH patients, including children.
The hospital opened on this spot in 1887. The 1912 annual report includes a long list of diagnoses that landed people at what was then called the State Asylum for the Insane, including alcoholism, sexual perversion, and melancholia, as well as the feeble-minded, now referred to as intellectually disabled. By the 1940s, the place was packed with hundreds of patients, including many World War II veterans, and the population topped 2,000. In 1970, the Arizona State Legislature voted to discharge anyone who was not deemed a danger to themselves or others, and patients streamed onto Van Buren Street without much more than a few dollars and the clothes on their backs. Like the inner workings of the Arizona State Hospital, specifics of just how our brains work can be hard to come by. Blair Braden is a researcher at ASU, specializing in autism and aging.
So we understand the behaviors associated with autism, but we don't understand the biology that's contributing to them. We really don't know that much from a research perspective. I would say the things that we do know, broadly speaking, is that most cases of autism are caused by a variety of genetic differences that are really hard to pinpoint in any one individual.
Today, ASH houses fewer than 400 patients, including Matt Solon.
Well, if I could sum it up in one word, I would use the word torture.
About half are in the forensic unit for residents with severe mental illness who have been found guilty of a crime and ordered by a judge to get treatment. The rest are civil commitments, those who are considered a danger to the community but haven't been charged with any crime. When you think of autism, you likely recall that diagnosis rates among children began to climb in the mid-1990s and continue to soar. But unless you have a family member or are otherwise close to such a person, you probably don't think or know much about what happens to an individual with autism when they reach adulthood.
Some kids eventually appear to outgrow their symptoms, depending on their level of need. Remember, autism is a spectrum, and the kind of therapy they receive in younger years. Applied Behavior Analysis, or ABA, is a very intense program that trains children to behave more, quote, normally, and in recent years has fallen out of favor with many people in the autism community. This in part explains the sensitivity many have toward the idea of therapy for adults with autism.
And then there's the reality of how adults with autism are received by society. Cynthia McCluskey is director of advocacy for the Autism Society of Greater Phoenix.
I think that when you're small and cute and young and easily directed, that's where some people like to stay. And the older that you get and the more needs you might have, the more opinions you might have, makes it maybe more difficult to work with and treat.
But the number of adults with autism is going up as kids on the spectrum age and adult diagnoses increase. It's tough to know how many of those people have a dual diagnosis. But the problem is significant enough that in 2022, the federal government created the LINC Center, housed under the Administration for Community Living, and designed to help people with dual diagnoses of intellectual and developmental disabilities and mental health conditions. Jennifer Johnson, a member of the Administration for Community Living executive team, says the work is just beginning.
There's a lot of challenges in terms of not only, you know, the challenges in terms of us not having national data on this population to know exactly how many there are and sort of their co-occurring conditions and their general health status, but also it's hampered by the fact that it can be very hard to get a differential diagnosis of somebody with a, is it their intellectual disability? Is it a mental health disability? Sort of truly understanding, you know, the differences between the two.
The national data isn't there, and the local numbers at ASH have not been made available. But it is known that serious mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder occurs more often in people with autism than it does in the general population.
Researchers are just beginning to ask why. Arizona State University's Blair Braden.
A lot of genes contribute to autism risk, and then things that people experience in their environment that we don't have a good handle on either.
While researchers grapple with the hows and whys, many people impacted by autism and serious mental illness are just trying to make it through the day.
It was way quieter and less overstimulating in jail than it is at ASH, which I found nuts.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankra.
And I'm Amy Silverman.
KJZZ is part of the Mental Health Parity Collaborative. Partners include the Carter Center and newsrooms in select states across the country. Good morning. It is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Phoenix is a transitional place. It remains one of the fastest growing metropolises in the country, so the barrier to entry here is low. But it also seems to have a ceiling. Some of the most influential people here make their mark and then leave. They hit the ceiling. They head off for greener pastures. This is the gray area we explored in our series Exit Interview, and with a slate of Arizonans who stuck it out in staying power. But now, some of those people who left are back. Did you miss us?
Oh my gosh. I always knew I was going to come back eventually. There's just something special about Arizona.
Chef Tamara Stanger. She built her career in the Valley, working her way up the restaurant chain here, finally opening her own spot, Cotton and Copper in Tempe, and working to define Arizona cuisine in the process. She's known for using native desert ingredients you can find all around you here in her food. She once took me foraging for mesquite pods in Papago Park. But when the pandemic hit, her restaurant closed, and she took a job where she grew up in Utah.
It's been weird being in a different place with snow.
In her exit interview, she told me she never really wanted to leave Phoenix. She felt like she had no other choice.
But now she's back, this time in Flagstaff. She's taken the helm at Shift, a tiny restaurant that's gained big acclaim since its opening in 2016. And she told me it feels like coming home.
It's the culture. It's the things that grow. It's the heat does something crazy to you. I don't know. I miss the food. I missed a lot of the projects I was working on before. Mm-hmm. And so coming back is just like, I feel like I never skipped a beat. Like I'm ready just to get back into it and just keep going and rediscover what Arizona is and what it means to me.
Yeah. Yeah. With a new perspective, I'm guessing, right? Like you were one of these chefs for a long time here that was really working to kind of identify and create, you know, a definition for what Arizona cuisine is or was. Tell us about your time in Utah. What did that help you learn in that mission?
I grew up in Utah, so it was mostly like my identity of why I understand food and why certain kinds of foods are important to me, because I grew up in the mountains, I grew up foraging, I grew up around the sense of, you know, the food that surrounds you, that's what you eat and that's what's important to you. So getting back to that was like really defining who I am, but also I learned more about sustainability. For the past couple years, I've been raising chickens and you know, growing food. And so before I depended on farmers, which I still will, but it's really cool to understand that side of it too, of like, this is food that I prepared the ground, I planted the seeds, I nurtured it, now I'm growing it, now I'm feeding it to you. Your scraps are going back to me, I'm feeding it to the chickens, these eggs are going back to you. And like doing this cycle, that's something I think I was missing before. And so it's really cool to do that now and understand it pretty deeply now, to where I can take this food to another level, to where, you know, it's deeply Arizona and these are things that distinctively grow here, but also like I'm now involved in that growing process, not just the harvesting process.
That's really cool. Yeah, because so much of what you did in Arizona as a chef was harvesting and foraging for those native ingredients. I wonder this because I've asked you this question before, like what Arizona tastes like. I wonder if your perception of that has changed and you know, how it compares. Like what does Utah taste like, for example?
Yeah, Utah and Arizona are so different. I mean, Utah obviously has the same kind of native connection that's really old, but it also had this huge disturbance of when the pioneers came through and they really changed everything. Like it changed what the food was. They did take from a lot of native ideas and kind of made it their own. Arizona was more like a trade route that people came through. And so it was a lot of native peoples, but then, you know, when the trains were built in Utah and across that way, we got a lot of Asian people that came down and they did most of the farming. So like Arizona is really distinctive in Asian cuisine. And then a lot of the people that came up from Mexico and from deeper South Americas came up and they traded food. And that like is distinctively the food in this area. But I think Arizona Southwest isn't the same as New Mexico Southwest. It's not the same as Texas Tex-Mex Southwest. It's not the same as Baja California. It has its own distinctive flavor.
Yeah.
And that flavor is very native and it's very ancient and it's old. And it tells a story about the deserts. When I talk to my native farmers, they tell me about like understanding the deserts is you have to listen. And every plant, every mountain, every ravine has a song. And that's how you find the food. And it's just like really understanding the earth helps you understand the food that you're eating. And it's not just like going to a grocery store and buying the most beautiful produce you could see. It's like taking this ingredient and how do you honor this ingredient in so many ways? How did people used to honor it in the past? And what can we do with the future when the climates keep getting hotter? And how do we preserve foods and feed people still? So
yeah.
That's a big thing of a part of Arizona.
I wanted to ask you about that. I wanted to ask you about the climate change reality we're living through right now in Arizona. You're in Flagstaff now, so the heat won't be as much of an issue, hopefully, for what you're doing at Shift. But it's dry. Like, we have not had almost any rain, not a lot of snow up there this year so far. We're seeing these real world impacts of the changing environment in our state in a very real way. What do you think that means for the food here? What do you think that means for what you're trying to do?
it impacts us, especially because, I mean, Arizona already faced a lot of water shortages. And I think the idea is we do need to embrace certain types of foods that require dry farming, like they don't need a lot of water. Up here in this area, we can grow more fruit. So like growing more fruit trees and just like spreading that and learning to eat these types of foods and incorporate it into your diet is a huge way to kind of save us in the future. Up here in this area, we still have like so many things that grow wild, wild grapes, wild cherries, apples, like berries. There's so many things that grow up here. I think that's one thing to embrace is what's the sustainable things that are still going to be here when the water is not as abundant.
Hmm. So tell us, tell us about joining Shift and being in Flagstaff in this different region of Arizona. What kinds of native ingredients are you pulling into the food so far? What are you excited to explore?
Well, it's quite an incredible place, but I have a lot of plans bringing in some game meats. Like I love working with rabbit and mesquite for sure. I've already started using and different types of corn. Luckily, I have so much juniper in the area I live in. So I have more juniper than I could ever. The wild yeast on a juniper berry is really good for making sourdoughs, making like quick ferments, and then burning the branches that sustains all the natural vitamins and minerals inside the plant. And so it's really great using wood ash to nixtamalize food to enrich it with calcium and other things that aren't like normally available in foods. That's one thing I'll be putting on the menu soon, is I love the incorporation of wood ash into food. There's a lot of restaurants doing a really good job creating really great food. And I feel like I'll be able to have a format here to really bring Arizona into the picture. And I don't know. I'm coming in as a white belt. I'm not coming into being like, I know what I'm doing. I'm taking over. I'm coming in to be like, hey, I have something to offer you, and I'm going to find my place quietly and then loudly. And I think that Flagstaff's ready for it.
Yeah. We will see what happens. Tamara Sanger joining us, executive chef at Shift in Flagstaff now. Tamara, thank you so much for coming on as always, and good luck.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. The Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts at ASU has a new leader. Renee Chang took over as dean late last year after working at schools including the Universities of Michigan, Minnesota, and Arizona. She spoke recently with my co-host Mark Brody about her goals for the Herberger Institute and what she thinks the role of the arts and design is in today's society. But they started with what appealed to her about coming back to Arizona to take this job.
I think really it was ASU's charter and meeting Michael Crow and seeing what he's been doing with it. The charter of inclusion and access and the taking fundamental responsibility in society, that's something unusual for public higher ed, but actually is very much in keeping with what I think public ed was founded for. And so really seeing how that plays out at the ASU scale was quite intriguing, as well as Herberger is one of the largest and most comprehensive design and arts institutions. And so that was to be able to lead that and see what we could do together was something that was really exciting.
How do you find all of that plays into design and the arts? Like the idea of inclusivity and, you know, sort of standing for something, it seems like kind of what you're saying. Like, how does that fit into arts and design and what you're doing now?
Well, I think that's actually a core differentiator compared to a lot of other places. There are times where art is seen as a luxury for an elite group of people that have time and resources at available. And I've always thought of art as really integral with enriching one's life and making one able to prosper in society. So art and design, you know, a friend of mine likes to say, we all live in a designed world, but the quality of that design is what determines who's thriving and who's not. And so it really is so much part of everyone's lives, even if they think of it as some separate thing. And trying to make more clear what we can do together and how those aspects of life can help us with sometimes intractable problems that don't seem to be related to art could actually be revealed by practices that we use in art and design.
Yeah. How do you try to sort of practically use that philosophy that you have to, as you say, sort of solve problems or maybe make the designed environment better for people for whom it hasn't been good so far?
Right. So there's lots of examples that I can show you. But one, for example, is we have a whole set of researchers working in for aging populations or for children that are neurodiverse that are looking at how light and sound affects their ability to focus and being able to provide refuge spaces or information for caregivers so that they can set up the space in such a way that those children or those elder adults begin to engage more fluidly and with less stress on them. So that would be one thing. We also have recently an amazing, we won the X Prize, which is a major international prize for solving a really difficult problem. And this was to measure biodiversity in the Brazilian rainforests. Hmm. And we had researchers working with a wide variety of scientists looking at how do you sample sound to look at the chorus of birds, not individual birds, to measure biodiversity that now can be used for setting up the strategies for increasing the biodiversity and using that to measure investments.
Let me ask you about something that you brought up a moment or two ago in terms of thinking that art is not a luxury. Art and design are not luxuries. I'm wondering, because I'm sure you have heard this in the past, that like, tell me exactly how a painter, you know, solves a problem in the world, or how does, you know, going to see a dance performance, it can be delightful, but how does it solve a problem in the world? What's the real world impact on that? As opposed to, you know, some of the design elements or architecture, or some of the, you know, some of the examples you gave. I'm curious what you say to people when they say, how does, you know, looking at a painting, you know, make my world a better place or solve a problem or, you know, any of the other, you know, fine or performing arts maybe.
Right. So I can give an example of a faculty member, Ben Timpson, who does portraits of Indigenous women that have been lost either through a variety of means, crimes or other social gaps in the social network. Mm-hmm. And he takes their photograph and he renders it with butterfly wings. And they're fairly large format. And he works with the family members. And it's a way for those family members to honor their relative, as well as to elevate for other awareness that this is an epidemic. At the same time, these are beautiful portraits, but they have embedded in them all of this other meaning and all of this potential impetus for action. And so there are times where by trying to come at a topic with words only is dry or doesn't really touch the emotional or the social heart of things, that performance or music or other senses begin to provide pathways for connection. And that, I think, is particularly when you come across issues that are tragic and difficult to solve and complicated, that would be one area. Another is when you think about climate change and how it can feel like it's kind of abstract, and you hear that, you know, the global temperature rise like 1 degree, and you think, oh, that's not that bad, right? But when you start to feel the difference in the number of fires, the days of excessive heat, there are ways that art and performance can make things visible and put in more perspective things that are happening slowly over time. And so that is another role that art and design media can play.
It sounds like what you're saying is getting information across to people in a way that might be a little different, maybe a little more interesting to them. Maybe it's a more effective way to relay information to people than just, you know, giving them an article to read or talking to them about it, that kind of thing.
So people process information in wildly different ways. And if you look at how, and also depending on where they are in their lives, if you look at children, they communicate a lot through dance and song and building forts and playing roles. And that is a really important way that they discover the world. They understand the relationship to others. And over time, we actually kind of educate out of that and say, well, now you can put that away and do your math and do your science. and do your writing. And all of that's important. But my argument is that stop putting it away and start keeping the continuity, because there are ways that you can connect with others, understand the world, that are through these other media that we tend to forget are these powerful tools that we regulate as less valuable somehow.
Do you find that to be a difficult argument to make? I wonder, especially now, given all the conversations going on about, you know, what is important and what is not, and what should we be spending money on as a society and what should we not be? Like, how do you find trying to make that argument right now?
I think that people are often surprised by that argument, but then if they think a little bit about it, they realize that the idea of empathy and connection, especially today when there's so much isolation, is often done through things that we can all do. Right? So if you recall people to their own experiences, they pretty much all can understand what that power might be and start to open up possibilities that it could relate to these much bigger, broader issues around social isolation or around climate change, which is not maybe an automatic connection that they've made without prompting.
All right. That is Renee Chang, Dean of the Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. Renee, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you. It was wonderful to talk.
All right. That is it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Please join us again tomorrow morning with much more. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.